Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Kuinos Hermes, my friends, deep bow to Sophia as always. You're in for a treat because we are on the soul train with Coltrane. Not St. John the Divine, but still, we're going to get into the love supreme. And the wonder point is high. For the atmospherically inclined, the wonder point is the spiritual equivalent of the dew point. And just like with the dew point, when the wonder point gets high, the atmosphere becomes saturated with the redolent presence of wisdom, love, and beauty, and the skies could open up sweet rain of liberation, inspiration, salvation across the nation. And even though the soul cannot be defiled, we know that the soul of Turtle Island could use a little bit of that cleansing rain. But let me introduce you to our guest, my friend Coltrane. Coltrane Lord is a psychedelic integration specialist, artist healer, and foundress of Wonderland Project. The wonder's right there, friends. It's a nonprofit organization that connects marginalized women who suffer PTSD due to domestic violence, rape, or sexual exploitation to trauma-informed psychedelic plant medicines, care, and integration. Coltrane is interested in the intersection of spirituality and science, ancient wisdom for modern times, and how our unique perspectives can merge to elevate the soul of humanity and reverence for the planet. Coltrane Lord, my friend, welcome to Dangerous Wisdom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thank you for that really creative introduction with my pretend namesake. I always tell the story that I was conceived to the Love Supreme, but the story, the real story is not that exciting, but so I appreciate that. I appreciate your creativity.
Oh, why, thank you. You must have been just inspired by the sense of that story. A Love Supreme, yes, St. John. You know, did you go to St. John's Church in San Francisco? They have a Church of St. John Coltrane.
I have. I have been struggling with identity for my whole life. And when I saw that church, I thought, I really must go. And there is something interesting about a name that is given and then a last name that my Coltrane Lord and then John Coltrane is Lord Coltrane, they say sometimes. So it's very interesting. But to study and to not study fully, but to be interested in this name and to see how passionate and spiritual his followers were and how he is so spiritual, I got very into his music. Mm. And I've been to church. So it's fun to have such a unique name that is very androgynous. And sometimes I'll share my things as Lord Coltrane, just to be a little anonymous, but then,
yes.
Coltrane is the name.
Yeah, I could picture a Saturday Night Live skit. Lord Coltrane. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, that's Lord comma Coltrane. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you're Lady Coltrane.
I'm Lady.
Right, but now when you say identity, which is I find that interesting as a person who, you know, we all have these cultural things, and you have Southeast Asian cultural heritage, right? I'm first generation American from Greece, so that's interesting. Tell me when you say I have these identity issues, and then I went to go see the St. John Church.
So identity crisis, I guess, for a lot of us first generation Americans. I come from a culture from the Philippines, and that culture in itself has been raped and pillaged many times from different cultures. Yeah. And so there's a lack of indigenous wisdom there, and there's a lack of a culture that it hasn't been destroyed by dominant cultures. Mm-hmm. And so when I go back to lineage, doing a lot of lineage work, healing lineage work, I don't feel that I have roots, that I have deep, deep roots. I feel like there's that even my culture, my heritage is finding its roots. And since coming to the United States, or my parents coming to the United States, and me having an experience with parents that ate with their hands, that didn't speak the same language, and were poor, and were struggling racially themselves, I never kind of found roots, basically. And then even my when I did my 23andMe, I would always go, when I was just exploring my spirituality, I would go back to India or Egypt. But then when I did my 23andMe, I have a percentage of Egyptian, which I was very excited about, because I want to find something that I could be rooted in spiritually as well. Mm. So
that's really a deep issue for so many people, because everybody was indigenous. And this question of what even indigeneity means, there are certainly many indigenous thinkers, people who we would just naturally identify as indigenous thinkers, who say, well, everybody's got to re-indigenize, including us, because it's so destabilizing. Conquest consciousness destabilizes. Mm. Even, of course, the Greeks, there's been all this discussion about why the British have our artifacts, why everybody has our artifacts. And, you know, the people forget that that happened in places that we identify with the dominant culture, and that there was a lot that was lost from even the Mediterranean basin, including Greece, Egypt. There's so much that we're still recovering. And Egypt mm-hmm. was such an important place. You know, it was kind of like the New York City of ancient times. You went there to make your way and make your name and learn, mm-hmm. Because there was so much stewardship of wisdom there. Mm-hmm. Mm. Wow. So yeah. That's, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just thought that when a culture is also forced to adopt a religion, then it's a shallow act. I felt like for me, I was raised as a Catholic, and I felt like there's a lot of inconsistencies and a lot of there's a lot of shallowness to that practice, where I was searching for depth. I was searching for roots of things. And so, you know, I will study and go back in time. And then, you know, originally there is in Egypt, and originally in Greece, or originally in Sumeria. That's where I tend to go in terms of trying to really find the source of the source, if you will.
Yeah. Well, and that's there are lots of wonderful wisdom traditions that have been preserved. But it's interesting, too, that in relationship to Greece, that triumph of Christianity over the old Greek practices, there was a lot of fight in particular about psychedelic medicines, which we might get to talking mm-hmm. about. And there was a recognition that this just was so deeply, deeply Greek that it was going to end something, you know, and there is... It's funny the ways in which there are people in the dominant culture who sense connections to ancient Greece. And that has happened across other cultures even, you know, for instance, former slaves who, you know, 100 years ago, who got interested in ancient Greece. And it continues to this day, because they were trying to take care of something. They weren't the only culture doing it. Mm-hmm. Democracy, mm-hmm. wisdom traditions, all these things that really aren't like what the Greeks had in mind. We're so far away from it that we really did lose something, and we're mm-hmm. so different from what mm-hmm. Plato thought of as therapy for the soul, as philosophy, mm-hmm. as love, wisdom, what Socrates thought. They both experienced those psychedelic initiations. They were mm-hmm. initiated, Socrates was famously initiated by a woman, a priestess, and all that's really lost. It's really... And what a big shift. And maybe now we might have a renaissance, but I think we would have to learn the lessons from the failed renaissance. We didn't really have one, you know, it really wasn't. It was just kind of like it was going to become a new paradigm, but not really in touch with what people were seeking. That, just what you're talking about. That was like, they were trying to say, there's got to be something that we've lost that is deep. And we're trying to find our way back to that depth, I think. And that's a big part of your work.
Yeah, and I think that even today's quote-unquote renaissance has a potential to backfire if we don't include the ancient wisdom with the modern aspect of mental wellness and healing.
Mm-hmm.
That's my personal opinion of trying to really bring back just remember some of our ritualistic wholeness and our connection to something more than just healing. Spiritual journey is a healing journey. So I do feel like getting into this, I do feel like our healing journey is our spiritual quest. It expands into our spirituality, and we're doing this for a reason. Mm. But that's hard to say sometimes to people who are actually in their trauma. It's a very different balance of language that we have to use.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Of course. Yeah. That's the thing, is that you have to try to find out where people are at and how what their window of tolerance is. And sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes it's going to go a lot slower than anybody would really prefer, maybe. But that's just the way it is. Things just take the time that they take. It's interesting that you know, there, too, we really agree. There is something in the etymology. I don't always think that etymology is something we should use as a strong argument, but it can be nice as a poetic refreshing of the mind. But healing and wholeness and holiness all have the same root.
Absolutely.
So that non-duality, the issue that what I refer to as the self-help catastrophe is the division, really. I can pursue my healing, and there are just more and more ways for me to do that that could not even have been imagined. The fact that somebody can get on an airplane and fly 3,000 miles to pursue their healing. But then what that tends to do is pull apart our healing from the healing of the world, and we tend to get on our healing path as part of the degradation of the very conditions of life that we depend on. We don't see how we're perpetuating. It might be the very trauma that was in our body. Somebody's body is paying the price for the oil to come out, for the things to happen. It's really a nuanced place to be. How do we bring those together?
Yeah, and I think that's our quest now, right? And I love that, because I say when we are whole, we are holy. That's my version of it. We are whole, we are holy. And I feel that in my heart and soul. And so, yeah, that's the delicate balance of trying to heal our own wounds, but then also returning to consciousness as a whole and saying, how does my healing connect to the healing of the whole? But also even going further than that and going and looking back, because this is all creation, right? We're all creating something as we heal each other, as we get inspired to heal by each other, but also turning back to the source of wholeness, to source itself, and saying, I recognize that this great inspiration to how to do this properly and together, where we're not extracting, where we're not appropriating, where we're actually healing the land as we heal ourselves. I feel like, for at least as being a woman, how we treat women and how we treat the land is kind of the same thing. And currently, women and the land aren't being treated as a divine being, as a divine essence. And I hope we can go back to that. That's why I do a lot of going way back into culture and, you know, the Neolithic times when the goddesses were revered.
Yeah.
I want to remember that so that I can look at something, that I can imagine something that is different than what is going on today.
Yeah, yeah. And that can come with just so much of an alignment because, for instance, when people engage with the land directly, that can be healing for them. And so that's a very obvious place where healing self and world can come together. And so that it's because still I think we're a little bit on the let me heal myself and then I'll go and try to pay something back. And how can we begin to look more and more? Because it's also the fact that the dominant culture is clearly very good at producing trauma. And so this too speaks to how do we get out of the pattern of insanity that produced the trauma and is still so intertwined with the ways we're trying to heal it. How can we continue to shift?
Yeah. And I think, as you know, with psychedelics, you are entering an unknown, and we, you know, there's a moment in time where we just say, oh, I'm just going to let go and be in this unknown. And I think that relationship, that courtship of the unknown, is something that if we can cultivate that, then maybe new opportunities or new insights can come, because we have been on the hamster wheel of doing the same thing the same way in a patriarchal dominant culture, domineering culture. And we just haven't created any space for space, unknown, the no thing, to actually allow us to birth something completely new. And so it is even removing ourselves from words sometimes. We talked about language. Sometimes over-explaining things and trying to dissect things versus experiencing things in our body that we know is true may help us to get to that point. And you sharing stories of people who aren't, you know, I'm not famous or anything, and you're willing to listen to a point of view that maybe a lot of, you know, a lot of philosophers like other philosophers, a lot of philosophers like people in that, in their realm of consciousness or their realm of being. And so to, you know, I'm grateful that a lot of people are now, or you are now, pulling out just people that are, might potentially be interesting to allow something, another seed to grow, another perspective, another, another way of seeing something. And I think that's very important to create the diversity of thought and to create the, maybe even the diversity of those different sparks of creation that need to happen right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a, I mean, this is a classic issue, is how do we move from the known to the unknown? Because if we're suffering, the only way we will be free from suffering will be reflected in our capacity to think a thought that we cannot possibly think right now. It has to be, if it's some variation even of the thoughts that we think, it's not going to be it. So there's a famous Christian text that's quite good about this. It's a mystical text called The Cloud of Unknowing.
I love that.
It's very much about this. You have to enter the cloud of unknowing, because whatever the divine is, it can't be anything you know, or else you'd know it already. You'd be healed and holy, and that's it. But there's something about that process of how do we let go without just being, just losing our discernment, or because then we start to think we're, it's okay to celebrate ignorance in certain ways, as opposed to this activity of not knowing that demands the whole of ourselves. It really, it presents a lot of challenge. And so we do need the readiness. That's where the, some of the concepts happen. You know, in the history of philosophy, concepts have done really two important things, because we are all conceptual beings. We're all actually operating on the basis of a bunch of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so if the first thing the wisdom traditions do is to help you to find the ideas that don't really work, and you analyze them into oblivion, so to speak. It's not like some kind of, you know, grammarian, or, you know, it's not this anal retentive academic process. It's just saying, well, think about that. Is that really true? And anybody can do that. I mean, Byron Katie has really kind of made a big reputation from just that part of it. How do I look at the ideas I have and find out, well, they're not actually very sensible, but I suffer when I think them. And then the other part of it is to say, well, since you aren't, we're not, until we're enlightened or until we're completely liberated, and even after, we're going to use some concepts. We're going to say, go start the car. We're going to say whatever, and we're going to have a spiritual life. So it, get the ideas that would orient you best toward that liberation, because of course you'll have to let go of all the words. They're never going to close down on reality, but some of those ideas, images, symbols, and of course, as you mentioned, rituals, rites, ceremonies, that's what they do. They orient that process so that you can say, oh, it's in this direction, something like that.
Yeah, and I love the, you know, this is why I work with psychedelics, at least, is that we get that felt sense of the metaphor, we get that felt sense of the dream or the idea or the vision, and we can go towards that. But there's also a danger. I love your title, Dangerous Wisdom, because there's also a danger in understanding where a person is at. I work with women who are in who are tender, who have been abused by sometimes gurus, right? And so it's that discernment of, in the body, is my body even at the place where I can feel the purest form of this message or this purest form of this metaphor, then, or am I desiring to have someone lead me so much because I can't lead myself? So that's where I find, that's where I find the delicacy of healing and also concepts and thought, because there have been, and I have experienced leaders who aren't healed themselves. And so there's an element of their own purpose versus the serving, the one who serves. And so there, it's all dangerous, but it's all necessary for our growth and our evolution.
Yeah. Well, yes, the serving and the attending is really important, and it's not easy. Yeah, because obviously if we just knew then we wouldn't need teachers. And when you look at these traditions, indigenous traditions, wisdom traditions, the teachers matter, and they offer us teachings we're not going to get. But the teachings are, again, what they do is point the way. Mm-hmm. And we can't always take it. I mean, sometimes, you know, for all kinds of reasons, sometimes teachers have to take risks. If they're ethical ones, and it's not about something inappropriate like a sexual advance or something like that, but or telling somebody to do something really extreme, but if it's an ethical risk of, well, you know, come to this meditation retreat, I think you're ready, that's one thing, and that can go, that already can be at risk. Mm-hmm. I know Mingyur Rinpoche, this really well-known teacher, he had panic attacks as a child, but mm-hmm. his dad still let him go on a three-year retreat, and he was 14. And he sat there and faced that panic.
Right.
And, you know, that could have just been in a different context or something different about the student. And that just could have been a story that we're reading in the headlines and thinking, oh, this is a horrible thing. But all he did was let his son go on this retreat. And his son, having learned, could then really sit and say, that's it, I'm going to face this panic. There's nowhere to go. Let's face this. So it's nuanced, and it's interesting because the Buddhist tradition really emphasizes, they take it to the, of course, they always go to a high level because Buddhist psychology is very sophisticated. Their view is that the very best teachers are ones that actually sense what you need on the basis of past lives as well. Mm-hmm. And so that really puts the bar high for the teacher, saying, okay, look, you've got to know this student in ways that you don't really realize. And there's a real big karmic burden just to even offer a basic teaching. In most traditions of philosophy, if something that would seem basic, like teaching the Four Noble Truths, in the Buddhist tradition, it would be that takes a long time before you can really talk to somebody about that.
Yeah, and so you teach like the psychedelic field or the healing field now, and any tradition right now, you can get a certificate in like 8 weeks, and so I just find that my own journey, my own healing journey, coming from a very troubled household, abusive household, I was under the impression that other people knew more than I did. And then so mm-hmm. you get to, you can get into leadership that is, I've never been in a cult, but sometimes I'm like, this is kind of cultish, like after the fact, right? After the fact, that's kind of cultish. That is leading me and all these people into a direction that maybe doesn't really work for me. And so I find that, to your point, it's very, very, it takes a master to really share. It takes a lot of inner work to really share. But then it's also understanding that maybe some people don't believe in past lives. I happen to. But also just the many selves in ourself, the many gods and goddesses that are actually living through us as us, and recognizing like which part am I, what part of me is drawn to this cult-like leader and potentially spending a lot of money healing when you throw over the covers and you're like, oh gosh, it's really the Wizard of Oz does not have any magic. And so it's very delicate, this healing journey, this healing aspect. And it's, I think, for me, trying to help women at least find discernment in themselves to discern what is a trauma expression and what is really the divine guiding you, your inner divineness guiding you. And it's very nuanced. It's very, very delicate. It's very exciting at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. But you have to trust the person who is telling you, this is the reactivity. This is that old habit pattern that you're laying on top of a current experience. And this person is not actually trying to traumatize you, but you're drawing on, you're putting that traumatizing figure onto them in a way to try to fight back now or whatever it might be. And it's not simplistic, but it is. It really takes a deep trust in a person to hear that, because otherwise, yes, you're being gaslit, right? And that is such a, because we have to recover that capacity to sense what's good and what's not good. We lose it. We lose it in it's pervasive in the culture, right? Because even food that tastes good is often really bad for us. And so like it's everywhere. It's not just our relationships with other human beings, our love relationships. It's all this stuff. And healing is part of that too. And sometimes even our concepts are restricting us there. And sometimes the concepts are ones that have been rooted in the say dominant culture of medicine. But dominant culture of medicine is not a bunch of idiots. And so I've also seen it the other way. I mean, I have a friend who fought against getting chemo for years, and then that was it, death's door. And they agreed. And they healed. And it was like, okay, you know, it's I'm not saying that's the only thing to do or the first thing to do or the best thing to do, but sometimes that's what's stopping us is I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And they're alive because they agreed to have chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. And there's a place for every, it's the merging of the two, right? The merging of the material and the spiritual that I think that how we are going to evolve as a human species. And I also, I believe that, you know, after this, after some people, because I want to make sure that anyone listening to this who is on a healing path that hasn't really reached a spiritual place in their path. So I'm prefacing this by saying, I very much understand where people are when they can't see a spiritual path on their path of healing, or a choice to do the material thing if they've almost spiritually bypassed, where they don't think that the 3D world is also a divine place. Like, we're here on this planet. I'm here on this planet. My soul chose to be on this planet in this body last time I checked. So I need to make sure that my sacredness is also on this 3D level. But then healing as we began, healing as a spiritual journey, I see all of this, at least in my own life and some of the women that I work with, it's my whole point is to heal. My whole soul purpose is to heal and expand and become that butterfly and then turn around and nourish the earth in beauty and love and in the ways that I've learned. And I feel like, I want to say this to all the women who are listening, who are in pain, that that journey of from trauma to transcendence, that journey is actually, you know, you pull out the biggest gift, the most powerful gift within you. And so take this journey of healing as a spiritual practice, because I believe that an unhealed woman is untapped resources. It's a really, really strong power of what we'll talk about, the shadow of, like, all those things that are so taboo and so so dark and sometimes sinister. Those experiences, the transcended state is pure power. And if we use that power for good and goodness and evolution, there's a lot of people who are out there that need healing. And if that is the source of our power and the power of goodwill to be transcended and transformed into something good, we can change the world. Mm-hmm. We can make things better.
Yeah.
If we can see it that way.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I would think that it depends on how we're defining spiritual, but I don't think it's really possible to heal fully without what we generally sort of loosely refer to as spiritual. The culture makes it difficult to talk about it because that sounds like it's immaterial, supernatural, as opposed to acknowledging that nature, as my friend Jeff Kripal puts it, nature is already super. Nature is super, and so we are super. And we have, his book is, he talks about how we were super before we were human, because the concept human only appeared long after we had discovered the superness. We had discovered things that we take to be outside the scientific paradigm, but our own science verifies a lot of it. It's very uncomfortable for some people to think about it that way. But then also another way to look at it, so thinking of diversity of views, I really am responsive to the idea that ecologies, I think that spiritual and ecological are not two realities. So if spiritual and ecological realities are the same, when we look at living ecologies and we look really at spiritual traditions, ecologies don't operate on the basis of power. They operate on the basis of a flow of meaning. Mm-hmm. And the problem with power is not that some have it over others, but that we agreed to a metaphor that doesn't reflect spiritual and ecological reality. If we just get rid of the metaphor of power and we understand that what has happened is the meaning of our life has been severely restricted, I'm just this, then we've lost the flow of meaning in the world and in ourselves, because Buddha doesn't exert power over us. He tells us that you're just like me. Jesus doesn't exert power over us. These are not power plays, but they have opened themselves up into the broadest possible flow of wisdom, love, and beauty, which means the meaningfulness of life is there. Mm-hmm. So that's another way to think of it, I think, as well. But you're right. It's not because this thing seems meaningless, or it seems like it has taken the meaning of my life. When I'm deeply, deeply wounded, it's the meaning has been broken. And now I can't have the meaningful life I thought. But all that happened was that frame around the meaning got broken painfully, yes, horrifically, unfairly. But something else, as you say, there's a gift that could be found there if you can trust yourself.
Yeah, and the power, when I say the word power, I mean the animating force of life, the creation of life, the what gives us life, right? I mean, nature is power. Nature has a power in itself because it thrives, it's abundant. There's something, you know, there's nature in itself gives itself water, gives itself life, gives us breath, gives us food and nourishment. Our bodies heal itself. When I cut myself, it heals. I mean, there's very much magic in our planet, in the universe, in our own bodies. Yeah. And that is a power that I see that is not power over, that is false. Right. It, like, there is a power, a source of animation that we have that includes things that we can't even describe, like love, how anyone described that. And that is what is spiritual to me. It's just this magic that is nature, that is life itself.
Right.
That's spiritual. And that's bringing it home to me. That is taking a concept that is oftentimes, when we say divine, that's something unreachable to some people, or enlightenment to some people. I've been down those paths too, and I get messages of, come here, come home to your home. My body is divine. The land that I walk on is divine. The person I'm talking to is divine. And just making even just regular life be a ceremony, regular life be a ritual. And I find that to be so nourishing and so fulfilling now, when my previous incarnation in this lifetime has always been to search for something divine, to search something completely outside of myself for something meaningful and divine. And I have to do this because I need a purpose. Well, my current purpose is to be really, really curious of the unknown, really curious and really expectant that I'm going to, I don't know what the divine has to offer me yet anymore, because I'm just in that space of everything is in this moment, a divine grace, a divine kiss, a divine courtship that I'm having. So that's where I think we all can go. And if we all can get there, we're all curious of each other. We're curious about everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, without that, you can't wake up. I mean, the curiosity is deeply important. Buddha was referred to as the shramana, which means the seeker. But the seeking is right there, right now. Not I'm going to go someplace or I'm going to move, but you find it really in this intimate. It's the sense of wonder, right? And Plato and Aristotle, I think they meant different things. I always say, oh, well, at least they agreed that love wisdom or philosophy begins in wonder. But I think that Aristotle was a little just drier about it, like, oh, I wonder why that happened, which is fine. That's great. But I think Plato is a little more in your sense of like, whoa, this is all amazing. You know, like, what is all this? It's almost feels just more spacious. But it doesn't matter. The important thing is that mind of true wonder, really in love with the moment, in love with reality right now. That's you have to have that. You can't find your way through. And doesn't it shift it too? We say this in, it's like so pop psychology, but these wisdom traditions are saying, well, if you really wonder at your pain, it won't hurt as much anymore. And you'll find that somewhere in there is the thing that will open the meaning up again. Mm-hmm. But you have to have enough wonder at the thing, at this, you know, the uncomfortable, I want to get away from. I'm uncomfortable, I go. And they're saying, well, if you wonder at it, then it, and the same thing, it's like the wound can't stay a wound now. If I wondered enough at it and it became an insight, it's been transformed.
I love that. And I always wonder what the higher octave of pain is, or the higher octave of everything, right? That's just the duality. So if somebody comes in, and my own experience, some I come into this world and I am born into a world of dominance, and I am born into a world of abuse, and I'm born into a world of I have no power whatsoever. It's just all on top of me, and I'm forced to be a certain way and actually physically get assaulted if I am not a certain way or don't say a certain thing. Where if I'm curious about, like, why, like, how can I transcend this? What is the meaning of this? Oh, how about I am supposed to learn about my own personal power? And then what do I do with that? And then how, like, what is causing the parentage that I have to be so dominant, to be so angry, to be so abusive? They have pain too. So there's this beautiful way of being able to have curiosity and wonder in a process of healing where you all of a sudden have way more compassion than you would normally have for your perpetrator, because it doesn't make any action right, but it also allows you that forgiveness and that freedom, and then real true compassion for somebody who didn't have an opportunity to heal.
Yeah,
and then I see this on a bigger collective level in terms of male dominance over women, the patriarchy. And then I see this over, like, we just, a lot of us have our inner child that needs to be healed, and we're just reacting from that very pained place. And how can, as we as a collective, look at each other as if we were from a pained place and find that nourishing moment, find that love for a person so that they can transcend that piece of themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's looking at the world like that, the world, not being angry at the world or other people, but being compassionate, and then trying to figure out what that is as a collective, what we are really trying to heal, which is, of course, I have my own opinions, but it's loneliness. It's connection to something greater than ourselves. And how do we make that sexy to the world at large? I don't know. But I do think that that is really what it's always been. Just over that's where spirituality is always, that's where we're always lacking if we feel disconnected. It's our wholeness and our holiness and connection with others too. So the healing process, when we get are curious and we are constantly just asking questions, we become the witness. And that's a teaching from all traditions. Becoming the witness of our own life happens when we ask questions and we become curious.
Mm-hmm. And so you experienced trauma yourself, and how did that probably drove you through a lot of twists and turns in your journey. Mm-hmm. How did it bring you to where you're at now and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so I did grow up in a, you know, very traumatic household. I like to say that I very much understand a veteran at war, because I might have had the weapons of destruction, might have been a fist or a belt, and landmines might have been eruptions of rage. So being hypervigilant my whole life led me to attracting interesting people. I don't want to say this because a lot of people feel like they didn't attract certain energies in their life, and they didn't, but I did. I did, with my lack of self-sovereignty, I did attract a lot of different types of people that were domineering and in different ways. Maybe I thought I'm not actually going to attract my father in the most aggressive way possible, but I did attract a lot of passive-aggressive people that like to have control over me. And so I don't know. I just got sick of myself one time. I got married. I had kids. I think the children piece was very much like, I'm gonna protect my children at all cost. And when I had a betrayal in my partnership, which I was gut punched to me, because I thought that I attracted somebody completely different than my father. It turned into a search for meaning in myself, and was I going to stay? What was going to happen in my relationship? But every time I went on a healing journey, I always thought that I was going to be just healing this betrayal, but I was always going back to my childhood that I had completely forgotten about. I have completely wiped it out of my consciousness, because in order for me to live a different kind of life, I thought that I had to just turn that off and just be something else. And of course, we all know that when you ignore a pain or a shadow, it will rear its ugly head at some point in your life. And so I went on a healing journey, and I tried every single thing, including everything. There's not a thing that I didn't try, sexually, psychologically, healing. It was therapy, all different kinds of therapy, women's work, everything, tantra, polarity, all the things. And it wasn't until I tried psychedelics that I went, oh, okay. I was so good at not looking at the actual thing, if that, and the actual thing was my inability to see any goodness in myself, any safety, any worth in myself. So I projected everything onto other people. I had gurus that were, I've had extremely interesting healers and gurus that were false healers and false gurus. But of course, I was going to choose that. I had no other way of discerning or discernment. So when you go inward, started to go inward, and I think this is the beauty of plant medicine, which is allows you to go to you, but also to your other selves and to your possibly past life selves. Many of my journeys were, I went back to Egypt. I went back to these places where I was remembering the sovereignty and the divineness of being a woman. And that opened up curiosities in me that allowed me to go deeper into my searching, but also some of the spiritual paths that I was on. The teachings were great, and sometimes the teachers were not. It gave me a felt sense of that, of the meaning of consciousness and the meaning of creation and the meaning of, and the importance of never creating without consciousness, always merging the two. And so that's why I went on this deep dive of the psychedelic path and trying all these medicines and realizing that this is a very difficult path. A lot of people get taken advantage of also on this path. And I just wanted to allow women who, I didn't grow up wealthy. I grew up, you know, in dire straits, and it takes a lot. It takes money to do this. It takes a person that actually cares, that has no agenda. No agenda for money, no agenda, but to just give information so that you can make your informed choices, so that you can have someone to talk to if there's any feeling of discontent with a guru or a healer. And that's just, I feel like my journey of experiencing a lot of false gurus, if you will, and healers, and some great ones. So I get to compare the two, but I was introduced to a lot of people that probably shouldn't be in this field of healing or spirituality. Then I just realized that's probably part of my path, is to help another person see the path, not walk it for them, see it, share with them what's out there, reveal some of the shadow sides of what is supposed to be beautiful and divine. And so I'm kind of a truth. I envision we all get to truth, and sometimes you have to like pull up the mud in order to do that. And so I'm good at the dark side. I am good at not judging it. I am good at creating beauty through it. And so that is, you know, my gift to women on this path, is that piece. That's one of the things that I do to help women walk the path of the psychedelic path, so we can return to nature, return to wholeness, return to ourselves. Okay. With their own wisdom.
And so the Wonderland Project is that work. It is the work of your supporting women, mm-hmm. who do not necessarily have the means. as mm-hmm. materially, and maybe also we could say when we need healing, we might not have the kind of psychological resources mm-hmm. or but we're not aware that we have them. Mm-hmm. And so how does that work? How do you take what happens there? Tell me, just walk us through the process.
Yeah, so we'll work with, I partner with some retreat centers that only work with women, and have women's leadership. I'm all about women and women's leadership at the moment. And we sometimes curate experiences. I'm never doing it by myself. I will partner with a retreat center who has their own facilities, and we'll curate it with that retreat center. Currently, the only thing legal, truly legal, is psilocybin in Jamaica. And so trying to be as conscious as I can, we work with in like the Rastafari village and indigenous village, the people who are living on the earth, living even kind of our outcasts in Jamaica itself too. They're living on the earth. They've fought for plant medicine to be legal. And so they have a huge community of healing and living off the earth. And so we bring women into that community and I pay them, the community. And so it's all stays in Jamaica. The resources all stay in Jamaica. And we get a cultural experience through them and a healing experience that is ritual and holistic, and a little bit of teaching of the where it originated from, in little bit of history for these women. And then I give them free integration. And so we have, as much as I can today, I have worked with them deeply to say what feels extracting and what feels like appropriating, not just the medicines, but your culture. Mm-hmm. And so I just work directly with them. I don't pretend that I know what an indigenous culture needs. I've been down to Brazil and I will just ask them directly, what do you need? Because I know there's a lot of anthropologists out there that think they know what you need. But what do you need, and why, and what's your goal with having us come down, or what's your goal with having me here and visiting you? So nothing's perfect, and I'm always still learning, and I understand that. But I want to speak directly to the people that I think I'm supporting, and I think that versus somebody who tells me what I'm doing, because there's so much noise in what's right and what's wrong. And even the word reciprocity, I was told like, oh no, that's not a word you use because you're not actually being reciprocal. But that was for indigenous to the United States, because I got kind of a little bit confused by that. And then I understand that here in the United States, that reciprocity in indigenous communities means a bigger thing than just supporting a healing hut or a community. But in at least where I was in the Amazon with the Huniquin tribe, their word of reciprocity was, support us by spreading the news that you can bring people down there and they can do medicine in their forest. But also, they actually need a healing hut. They actually need a bathroom. And so, I prefer to take it from those villagers than somebody who's also appropriating somehow, some way, making money off what they're actually saying. So that's how we do it. I'm trying to bring education to women about reciprocity, and also just education on the power of giving back, even if you can't afford it, like sharing what they're doing in these villages or sharing about your experience. So that's how we do it at Wonderland Project.
Okay. And so Wonderland Project, as a nonprofit, then pays mm-hmm. for the expenses for these women to have the treatment work with the medicine. And how do you support Wonderland Project? How does the nonprofit itself?
Yeah. So just for anyone who wants to donate, you can donate. I have sponsors that donate to Wonderland Project. What I love is that mostly it's been women, because it's a very hard thing to talk about the injustices towards women. A lot of times the funds don't go towards women focused funds. That's in my experience. A lot of the funds go to veterans, which I very much understand and I get. And And the story of a veteran is very heroic and powerful and save the day. And so they must need healing. And yes, that is absolutely true. And women oftentimes don't choose their situations and oftentimes don't have actually a sisterhood like they have a community in the veteran community. They don't have a community because such experiences are very shameful. And so what I've found was it's very hard to actually raise funds for Wonderland Project, except for women who understand it, right? And I would love to have a bigger population who they do fund psychedelics, they do fund psychedelics and healing actually go towards women because, again, how we treat the earth is how we treat women, and the earth is almost the same thing. And so we aren't putting resources even into the earth. We still have climate change that people don't understand the beauty of being stewards of the earth. So that's my goal, is to figure out how to have that language and have that story be a empowered story versus a story that people don't want to hear. Mm. It is very hard for people to listen to someone who's been raped, abused, or sexually exploited, because we don't really want to think about where that t-shirt was made and how it was made. Mm-hmm. We don't really want to talk about, like, I heard this, and if you Google or chat GPT, what is the highest rate of sex trafficking in the United States? The answer will be the Super Bowl. But if you ask it a different way, is the Super Bowl the highest sex trafficked day? And they'll say no. But a lot of the sex traffic organizations will say a high rate of sex trafficked women being used as prostitutes or being used as being used is during the Super Bowl. Interesting, yeah. Just because of the nature of the event. Okay. I don't know if this is 100% true, so I won't. When you Google, that's what you get. And then you talk to organizations that work on this, that's what you get. Hmm. And so you have a lot of money being spent at an event like that, and we're using women's bodies to entertain people like that, and then no one wants to know that it's happening at this great time. At this event, no one wants to know that this is happening. And so the stories of this kind of experience, a lot of people just want to pretend that it's not happening because it's just too much. And so I'll be the bold one, and I'll try, and I'm going to do my best to try. And I recognize that it is a hard thing to listen to. And so I'm trying to discover still, it's a road, it's a process, not an end game. How to tell the stories of survivor leaders. I call it survivor leaders. How do we tell that story of transcendence? How do we tell that story of personal power that is untapped for, like, the world to use, to explore, to not use and take advantage of in that way? But, like, there's so much a beautiful resource in the healed person, let alone healed woman, right? And so I'm trying to finesse that piece. That's part of my job as founderess of Wonderland Project is to perfect that, mm-hmm. to try to perfect that so that people are interested, wake up to it.
Mm. Yeah, the it's such a profound challenge to break through the deep ignorance in the culture that is ultimately the source of all these problems, and isn't actually associated with some particular manifestation, but just takes all these different manifestations, and how do we get at it? It is unfortunate that some of the, I think even social advances that we made, you know, I think that part of how we've sometimes had certain social innovations has been because of soldiers and the wealthy recognizing that they did something that mm-hmm. served the protection of wealth. And so therefore, let's do the GI Bill, or let's have these social programs. And because this part of the population is actually keeping the whole thing going because of the structures, not because we have to have things be so aggressive and violent. But it is interesting that women in an ongoing way have their bodies on the line for us, and there's not enough recognition of how important it is to take care of that. And the culture is just really got a lot of confusion. There's just a lot of bad philosophy. Even Plato in the Republic talks about how the only way we could have a really healthy culture more rooted in wisdom, love, and beauty would be that women would have to be seen as capable of ruling, of leading. And we still haven't been able to manage that. Not that I've been fans of the most of the candidates, especially certainly the mainstream candidates are not that enticing, but okay. Yeah. Right. So then maybe, of course, maybe it's also about having more people just to recognize suffering in general and also in themselves. I mean, there's something nice about hearing that somebody went through something very difficult and then found genuine transcendence, that that part of it seems like it should be able to resonate. Sometimes it's too much, because you were talking about compassion, and I know that sometimes it's really too much for people to hear that the Tibetans who were captured, you know, there's a famous case of this one advanced yogi who was really brutalized. And the Dalai Lama asked him, how bad was it? And he said, oh, well, it was almost really bad. I almost lost compassion for my torturers. And that's extraordinary. But that monk, he doesn't show any signs of PTSD. So, and there are the people who were more kind of a little bit more skillful practitioners, that's fairly consistent. So on the one hand, you would think that to hear that, we would say, oh, well, then I'm very interested. Let's give me the teachings about the mind. How could I have that? On the other hand, it's like sometimes it's too scary, or we're uncomfortable, or it is. I don't envy this question, but in a way, I face it the same as a philosopher, because nobody really knocks on my door because they think they're doing great. A lot of times somebody has to be in a lot of trouble before they come, and then they want to hear what the wisdom traditions have to say. And there's a way in which I guess all philosophers are always asking, how do you make that sexy? How do you make the possibility for transformation and healing for everybody interesting enough that people will do it and support it? I mean, you know, I don't know. Buddhas convinced people, right? Because Socrates said, you should give me free meals for what I do because it's an act of service. And they killed him instead. Buddha said the same thing. You should give me free meals because it's an act of service. And it converted the whole society. And they established massive universities. There's this huge success in his saying, no, really, if you let me bring this medicine to the culture, this will benefit everybody. And it's like we're still wrestling with it. We haven't got it. So,
yeah, part of me thinks that, you know, I want to say to someone, you're in it already. You knocked at my door. Knocked at, and the way out of it is through compassion. Like, you're here already. You want more pain, or do you want less pain?
Right. Yeah.
Right? And it's like you're gonna go through the portal of healing anyway, and the easier way, you're going through it anyway. The shorter way is through compassion. The longer way is through anger and hate.
Oh, yes, yes. But I mean also just the fact that what you're trying to say is, well, how do I convince more people to want to support this, right? I mean, yes, the person who has to walk through that door, but then it's the person who acts like they, that question that you were posing, why would it be that one person will say, well, let's do this for veterans, but we don't have a similar program for women? And even if we just race to calling that patriarchy, I think that doesn't even necessarily help. If we just recognize, well, there's a problem of human ignorance here, but I still don't understand why it, you know, why would, how can we get more people to be interested in supporting healing broadly? And, you know, just like we all need this, and especially certainly we need to have an investment in helping women be healthy and feel vital and creative.
Sadly, this is what I think about people who are trying to build awareness for climate change and, like, you know, not extracting so much from the earth, but like, let's work together with the earth. Let's collaborate with the earth. The message is we need to save the planet. And so I think about that a lot. I'm like, it's important that we do this. It's important, but really because of the dominant culture, as you share, is they care about themselves and they care about their money. So I always thought, maybe we should change the message to the dominant culture will die for sure. Humanity will die if you don't take care of the earth. And that's as simple as that. You, human being, will die the earth might, the water might be green, the purple, the skies might be purple, but the earth will still be here. You will not.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'll be at Mars, you'll go to Mars, whatever it is, the humanity will die. And so it's the same sort of thing where, you know, sometimes I think with a patriarchal culture, with a consumerism culture, you will make more money if you support women. Like, if it's that simple, which is kind of sad to me, it's sad, but maybe that's it. You will have a better life if you support women. You will have a better, abundant existence if you support women.
Mm, yeah. I mean, the question might be worse, though. It might be that you can't continue with the system of money that you have unless you want everything to fall apart. So even making that promise wouldn't necessarily be helpful, because it could be that since that's part of the pattern, it's not that the notion of a medium of exchange is somehow inherently evil. That's not the issue. The issue is that money has its own meaning in this culture, and that mm-hmm. meaning is bound up with everything that's making us sick. So mm-hmm. so if there's not maybe not an easy way around that. And that's part of what you're doing, is you are rethinking how we support people who don't have this stuff that we call money, but they still should have access to healing. And we're using money and redirecting it, but maybe we're just slowly taking steps toward thinking a different way, or thinking about how we change what the meaning of money would be.
Yeah. And I hope you're a philosopher, and I believe in spirituality, and I feel like I'm a spiritual being living on this planet, and that piece is also spiritual. So I think sometimes what people in spirituality who are interested in spirituality do is they do stay up in this place, and they stop engaging with politics and with, I don't like politics either, but they stop engaging in real life, and they just have these communities of beauty, but it's small. I don't think that changes the world, really. I don't think that helps when you just isolate yourself. And so how do you bring back, it's a question, how do we bring divine back into our bodies, back into our communities? Yes. But then how do we bring this and spread it?
Mm-hmm.
How do we make it contagious? How do we make it a pandemic of love and beauty and wisdom? How is that going to happen? And I think it is about looking underneath the rug. And I think it is going, okay, how do I exist in this 3D world, this patriarchal world, and how do I make a slight difference in the place that I don't want to be in, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to live in a potential future where it's the Handmaid's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that to exist. A lot of my friends are leaving the country, and does that help? I don't know if that helps. I don't know if that helps or not. I feel as if just like the butterfly is turning into pulp and is like trying to find its imaginary cells to become that butterfly, I feel like that's an opportunity now that we have here in humanity. We're kind of destroying each other. We are destroying the fabric of humanity and consciousness. And then maybe more of us can remember, if we just kind of remember and tell more people, but in a way that they can hear,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the way you speak is so beautiful and eloquent, and I'm going to savor it forever. I love the way you speak and the metaphors you choose and how you present that. But then I think about the women that I serve, and they can't hear that right now. Sometimes I have to change my language too, because they just want to heal. They just need to have food on their table. They just need to work. And so it's a process that I'm actually trying to figure out, but how do we as a general, those of us that have tasted the divine, that know what it's about, and that have healed some wounds, you have clients that are healing wounds, how do we take that and even bring it into a language that somebody will actually act on? Because I think that this is our innate humanness is divine. I feel like everyone knows that when we look at children. I mean, every domineering person, human, in the world that we can even recognize now, they were a little kid once. They were a little kid that was probably hopeful and something happened. So how can we talk to that? That is a question of mine. That is as I exist on this planet and have had hard things in my life, but also got to experience the beauty of life. I got to do both. So I have to believe that I can actually many people can transcend. I have to believe that because it's happened in my life. You see it once, it could happen in many more. So it is a goal of mine as a human on this planet to tap into that and see how we can actually make positive change. Mm-hmm. When people don't know that they're hurting themselves.
Well, there, that's really big. When they don't know they're hurting themselves. I was thinking a little bit of Machig. Do you know Machig Labdrun? She was a great yogini who developed this process that was popularized by Lama Sotra Malioni, who's probably an interesting person for you to find out about, learn about, because she works a lot with the feminine in the Buddhist traditions, Machig in particular, and she transformed Machig's process in an updated way. Not like she didn't change it, I shouldn't say transform, but kind of like put it in language that is more accessible. Mm. It's a process called feeding your demons. Yeah. It really, when you study it, you will recognize it as a very holistic, much more holistic, much more spiritual version of internal family systems.
Oh yeah,
but Machig, this is 1,000 years ago that she developed this, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not it's really that this idea mm-hmm. of an inner ecology of mind was already available to us, and Machig's way of working with it is very sophisticated. So you get a very advanced female yogini, you know, that's a repetition, but you know what I'm saying. But who developed this, and it spread to every tradition in Buddhist, in Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. Everybody's got a version of this. It's called chud, which is to cut away the thing that's making you sick. I was also thinking of her teacher gave her a series of very short instructions, but what one of those instructions was, help those you think you cannot help, and another one was, go to the places that scare you. Mm-hmm. And she's mm-hmm. very much this kind of brave, bold yogini, you know, such an interesting figure, profound teachings. But to what you were saying, I also think it's so interesting that these different philosophers all present Machig, Buddha. You know, when Buddha was giving meditation instruction to somebody, and it's a famous instruction now, because of course it makes total sense that mm-hmm. he said, well, look, your mind, if it's... you have to think of it like a musical instrument, that mm-hmm. if the string is too tight, it won't play the right note. If the string is too loose, it won't play the right note. So it has to be just right. But he was explaining that to a musician, mm-hmm. and he was always like that, just mm-hmm. very much. And sometimes you can find teachings that almost seem contradictory mm-hmm. because it's just this, you just do this. And that's all true. And at the same time, you know, what's also fascinating is I think you're very open to the notion of bliss and transcendence, right?
Absolutely. I've felt it. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And what's so interesting is that when Buddha comes out of the forest, he doesn't run out of the woods and tell people the first thing, I've discovered bliss. It's all bliss. The first thing he does is he says, okay, there's suffering. There's mm-hmm. real suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's a remarkable thing. Even that. And the fact that maybe you could tell somebody else, no, but there's bliss. Mm-hmm. And it's what you're getting at so much is this, you know, I can talk one way with you, but you're right. Obviously, I can't talk that way to somebody else and in a different circumstance. And what do we say and how do we say it? Mm-hmm. Can we touch a little bit on bliss, though? Because I like that, you know, Bob Thurman just published a book a year or two ago called Wisdom is Bliss, because he wanted to address this thing, you mm-hmm. know, because people think all Buddha teaches everything is suffering. No, he teaches that you're stuck in suffering until you find that it's actually bliss. And so he was trying to be honest that we're suffering, but then also, okay, but what about all the bliss? What role do you think that plays, and how much do you think the stories of transcendence might themselves start to become magnetizing for people?
Yeah, so I mean, from a human level, where a woman's healing, for instance, example, my healing, I had no idea what safety, what safety even meant. And the moment that I got into a place where I finally felt safety, I finally felt worthiness, that gave me opportunity to be in the spaciousness, which I had to get used to, which you feel bliss. And people take for granted what freedom feels like. They don't have a clue unless they have not been taken free. Freedom hasn't been taken away. And when I mean of freedom, my version of freedom was safety in my body. I did not know what that felt like. And then this idea of bliss, sometimes, and back to language, some people don't even understand what that means. It can't even comprehend what bliss is. And so we need the language for what that is for each person. We're all individual experiences, right? We're all individual sparks of divinity having our own experiences. And so it is beautiful to say to me, bliss is freedom. Bliss is infinite joy. Bliss is love like you've never felt before in your body. And there's no one else but you around. Like, it's just for you, through you, within you. And at one point in life, I would think, I want that freedom. I just want to feel free. I just want to feel safe. That's what it would be for me. So somebody else might think, if they're looking for a partner, and you might describe bliss as the most exquisite relationship that you've ever felt in your entire existence. You don't even know how whole you would feel. You don't even know what how joyous this connection is with this divine essence that is you. It's without you. So bliss is also, you know, I think there's a universal bliss that we can compare notes, but it would land on somebody who is searching for their meaning in their life based on their meaning of their life. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would, if we do the chakra systems, if we go up that, it's like, if someone has safety, and maybe it's the worthiness that they're looking for, or maybe it's connection that, or maybe it's like, I would feel bliss if I was sharing my voice, or, you know, like just things that the level of trauma that they have. Mm-hmm. And then, or purpose, you know, some people just, they think highly of themselves, but they don't have their purpose.
Yeah.
And so bliss might feel like they are purposeful and they are connected to something greater than themselves, but they are contributing to that energy. Yeah. So what's your definition of bliss?
Yes, mm-hmm. Of course, I think it would be that. It's tricky because of what you're saying, that there's a level that has to do with what the experience of reality at 100% experience feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get tastes of it, because if you sit down to meditate, it's not that hard to begin to experience some bliss, but that mm-hmm. wouldn't be what I would think Buddha experienced. I would feel like somehow you're participating in it. Mm-hmm. But only somebody who's totally enlightened would be just, that's it, I am it. It's 100% without an egotistical thing or just nothing coming through. But you're right. I think it's what the experience of wisdom, love, and beauty flowing through our being, what mm-hmm. does that feel like when wisdom, love, and beauty are flowing through our being? Well, that's the word that we have for it, bliss. And it's itself difficult to handle, because I think that when this flow comes with a negative valence or a positive valence, it can overwhelm the ego. Now, mm-hmm. when it has a positive valence and it overwhelms the ego, we're okay with that, and we just still think it was bliss and it was great. But mm-hmm. when it is a negative valence and that same level of energy flows through us, then we actually will refer to it as trauma. And mm-hmm. in both cases, there is this issue of whether we're metabolizing it and whether we're actually not clinging to it. Because in our spiritual life, since we have some intuitive sense that, oh, that's just the way reality feels, then we mm-hmm. think that if we have it, we must be enlightened, or I'm spiritual now.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas you now are making that a new problem. If you mm-hmm. didn't experience it, yeah, you're not headed in the right direction. But if you think that that is it, or that now you've experienced that, then, oh, yes, I must be enlightened, then you're holding on to it, and it's going to start to cause problems. So bliss can be its own problem as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love the idea of, I guess sometimes people use the word pleasure, but I think I would like to use the word bliss. Is How can we even in our times of great suffering, feeling that sense of bliss at the same time?
Right.
And I have gotten that through plant medicine journeys where I'm just like, why am I doing this? But at the same time, I'm like really feeling this blissful moment of I'm doing it, but why am I doing it? But I'm actually doing it. And having to laugh in that moment of like, this is the absurdity of the profundity of the most divine craziness of what we're existing is this, you know, is heaven on earth, but like horror, but joy. I mean, it's just all in one aspect. And perhaps that is why we have to be so limited at one point, because it is confusing when you get it all at the same time. But then to me, I have experienced this where it's so confusing and I'm laughing at the same time as I'm in pain, but then you just transcend it into just pure oneness. And it's not all the time. I get it for a glimpse. I don't have it,
sure.
You know, I'm not living that right now, but I, you get that taste and you go, oh, this is the meaning. This is it. And I don't think anything else has given me that experience except for a plant medicine journey. But I will say that it took many plant medicine journeys to get to that place, because I was doing a lot of healing
sure.
of my trauma. And I think that there's levels of it. And then you, to your point of people going to bliss and thinking they're enlightened, I think sometimes, unfortunately, the danger, dangerous wisdom, the danger of doing plant medicine a lot and not ever going back and bringing it home, the lessons home, you think you're enlightened. You think you're there. And then all of a sudden you're QAnon and you're like, I've seen that. I've like,
oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, really? You think the world is flat now? So
that's why we need the good philosophy. We need a philosophy as a framework. And this is why, actually, you know, when Buddha, I had sent you a link for the podcast episode called The Buddha Molecule. And if you ever listen to it, you'll hear this story. If you don't, I'm sparing you. You don't have to. Why bother? But one of the things I talk about is Buddha said, if I perform a miracle, somebody asked him to perform a miracle. He said, no, if I perform a miracle, nobody will believe that the practice of philosophy made that possible.
Mm.
They will think that I had to have taken some plant or had a magical amulet.
Mm-hmm,
and that's
mm-hmm.
what they will use. So that's too also what is happening. I think Buddha would say, if you take that medicine, you'll think that the bliss is there, and you won't know that all the medicine did was reveal your capacity. So
yeah.
Then I can say to you that if you do, you can, if you get good meditation teaching, it's not that that's the goal. It's that you will find that you're capable. And there is this movement, I could say movement, maybe a little bit, it's small. But Buddha, one of the things that he taught were called jhanas, and so when you practice the jhanas, you experience bliss. And people are actively, they're for a while, this like wasn't talked about very much because it can be a distraction, and you know. But what some people are finding is that, wow, when we teach people this, they don't get addicted to it. It's not a thing where you're like, oh, now I'm just doing it. I mean, you of course, there's a risk for anybody to abuse anything. But a lot of what happens is people say, I cannot believe that I did that just by sitting here. If I can do that, what else can I do? And the turn is this discovery of bliss is right, that it's right there for you.
I actually can do that now. I don't know the practice, but I can tap into the bliss. I can tap into it.
Yeah.
I got there first. Yeah, I need to acknowledge I got there first with plant medicine. And I tell people, you don't need to do plant medicine all the time. I mean, I had to get there through it, because that's the lot of things, a lot of layers I had to get through. But I tap in. I tap in. And
yeah,
like some, I don't
there.
Know. I mean, I have to look at, I'll look up that practice, but I tap in and I'm tapped in and it's not an addictive practice. It's just I'm remembering that moment.
And then it's so helpful when you're hurting.
Yeah.
Like if there's pain, if you got a migraine, it's like very practical, or it's a stressful situation and you're able to just find that.
Yeah, or even just gratitude. Like it brings me presence and gratitude for the moment that I'm in. And that I think is medicine too. I think that gratitude and our presence is something that the words are there, but really pure presence is transcendent in itself.
Yeah.
And so it allows me to, it kind of refuels me quite kind of refuels me a little bit, and then allows me to gain insight, and I get into a cosmic realm that that I know is there always, but then I forget sometimes. I'm working with people and I forget, and I have friends that aren't on my path that, or family members that aren't on my path, and I just gotta, I get sucked down a little bit, and so, to in moments of solitude, which I love now, tap into my own bliss.
That's good. It's a good thought to end that way, and an invitation for anybody who's thinking about what are the pathways to bliss? What are the pathways to feeling good again in the world with each other? And how can we help each other to move in that good direction? So thank you for your work. And if for anybody can look at SUT, we'll put a link for the Wonderland Project if you want to support women's healing and support working with the medicines of our world in a good way. Then we'll have a link for that. Thank you. And thanks for joining us here on Dangerous Wisdom, my friend. It's really great
thank
to
you.
Talk to you.
Appreciate you. Thanks
appreciate
so much.
You. And thanks to all of you out there. If you have any reflections, questions, stories related to anything that we touched on today, please send them in through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of those questions into a future contemplation or dialogue. And until then, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. So take good care of them.